This Israel Report is brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands. Owning properties in Israel can be a great investment, but challenging to manage if you are based abroad. The Blue Agency will manage every aspect of your property, finding and vetting tenants, maintaining your property and getting it rental ready, negotiating contracts and collecting rentals, reporting back to you regularly. The Blue Agency has built a reputation for trust and confidentiality over 20 years. The Blue Agency, your Israel property is in good hands. Contact us at www.theblueagency.com.
The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, a very good morning. Boker Tov, how are you?
Boker Tov, we are going to talk a little bit more about the Ben-Gvir comments, but before we do that, I would like to talk about something new at the Allenby Bridge border crossing between Israel and Jordan. Now, this is an interesting border crossing because it crosses the Jordan River, and people think that it is quite a dramatic crossing on a bridge across the Jordan River. You kind of can conjure up in your minds all kinds of visions about this dramatic bridge that crosses the Jordan River, and it's really none of that. It's really quite an uneventful crossing for those who have experienced it, and I'm lucky enough to have done so. Interestingly, from the Jordanian side, it's not called the Allenby Bridge. It's called the King Hussein Bridge. So it's one bridge with two names, depending on which side you come from. But the important thing about the Allenby Bridge crossing is that it has a lot of traffic going backwards and forwards to Jordan, because many of the residents in the Palestinian Authority area choose to use that crossing when making trips abroad. And in fact, the truth of the matter is that some of them are even not really able to travel through Ben Gurion Airport due to passport issues. I'm not quite sure exactly what nationality passport they're traveling on. So the Allenby Bridge border crossing is really, really critical for them, and many of them do have family members in Jordan as well. So it's a very, very busy bridge, and up until now, the bridge has been open on weekdays from 8 o'clock in the morning until 11:30 at night, and on weekend days, which is Friday and Saturday, has been open from 8 until 3 p.m. And this has been a bone of contention. The Israeli government had been approached, in fact, by no other than President Joe Biden when he was in Israel, saying that he would like to request the Israeli government authorities to open the Allenby Bridge on a 24-hour basis in order to allow greater flow of traffic at more convenient hours through the night on that bridge. And actually this week, they finally implemented a trial just for the week to see how that would go. So this week, the Allenby Bridge border crossing has been open for 24 hours. The U.S. Ambassador Tom Nides chose to visit in the middle of the night, given that the president had specifically requested this, and the request had been delayed for some time. Originally, it was supposed to have been implemented in September, then it was delayed until after the Chagim. Then they decided that it might be an election ploy to open it up immediately before the election, so there was a delay until after the election. Finally, the trial has happened. And another little interesting snippet is that the King of Morocco, King Mohammed VI, also got involved and specifically requested the Israeli government to extend the opening hours of the Allenby Bridge. So now the trial has taken place just for this week. I'm not exactly sure what has transpired, what we've learned from this trial, but I'm guessing that if they found a lot of traffic moving through the Allenby Bridge in the nighttime hours when the bridge otherwise used to be closed, then I'm guessing that that trial would indicate that there is indeed a need to open the border crossing. And the way it works is that you go through, if you leave from Israel, you go through the Israeli immigration, then you have to catch a bus which crosses the bridge to the Jordanian immigration on the other side. You have to pay money to use that bus which crosses the bridge onto the Jordanian side, and then of course go through Jordanian immigration on the other side. The same on the return journey. Quite an interesting experience for those who have the opportunity to do so.
Absolutely, very interesting. Let's talk about this hot mic situation. So first of all, was it? Did he not realize, did the president not realize that his mic was on when he made these comments?
That's what we told. We told that it was a hot mic situation. And it's interesting that we've even got a term for this now, because it seems to happen so often that people inadvertently make off-the-cuff comments without realizing that they're being picked up everywhere. People need to understand that there's nowhere to hide. There are cameras everywhere. When you think that you can play, in the old days you used to play tok-toki, you know, going knocking on your neighbor's door, running away. Yeah. Those kind of games don't exist anymore, guys, because there are cameras everywhere and there are mics everywhere as well. And so whatever you say, you need to think will be heard in public, and this is exactly what happened. President Herzog did not deny that he said it, but there is a question about who he said it to and under what circumstances, because this was said at a meeting of the Shas party. Now, as I mentioned yesterday, he's been meeting all of the Knesset parties that have been elected to the upcoming Knesset to consult with them as to who they would support for Prime Minister, and that consultation process will continue today and also into tomorrow. And when meeting with members from Shas, apparently he made the topic that Itamar Ben-Gvir is apparently feared around the world. Those were the words that he used. And that there is, you know, trying to send them the message that there is a certain issue, a certain problem that is potentially arising in the upcoming government because of Ben-Gvir's participation, and potentially because he will be a minister with a relatively senior role. As somebody who has brought that many seats to the coalition, he would be entitled to choose almost a role, whichever role he would like. And Prime Minister-elect Benjamin Netanyahu is likely to have to give in to him because of the power that he brings with those seats in the Knesset. But Herzog wasn't apologetic about making the comment. He acknowledged it. He said that is the reality.
I'm not sure. You know, we've had terrible comments before. We've had the Obama hot mic just calling Netanyahu a liar. This is very different. He really is stating a fact that I would imagine even Ben-Gvir wouldn't dispute, that people are worried about what he will bring to the Israeli cabinet.
Well, so the interesting thing is that in acknowledging that he made the statement to the public, the announcement also went on to say that the president had told Ben-Gvir exactly the same thing. So he's not trying to speak behind his back in a certain sense, but that he has said this quite openly, not only to the Shas party, but indeed to Ben-Gvir as well. But the question is, what message was he trying to send to Shas? Why was he making the statement to Shas? Interestingly, the Shas comment was that he's kind of chilled out a little bit when talking about Ben-Gvir. Their view was that he seems to have chilled out a little bit in recent times and calmed down more than was the case previously. So Shas were coming at it with a slightly more balanced approach. But the president was making this statement to a potential member of a coalition, and I'm not really quite sure what his intention was. One could interpret it to mean he was trying to drive something of a wedge between potential coalition
parts. Send the message that you have a responsibility as part of this coalition to try and keep the more complicated members in line a little bit. And because we know that I'm assuming, is going to be one of the challenges that Netanyahu has, whereas it might be a strong coalition in some ways, this is going to be an angle he hasn't really had to deal with much in the past.
Well, as I said yesterday, I mean, we do have potentially a strong coalition. And what's interesting is that these coalition partners were signed up to this coalition for some time already. So this is not just something that's been constructed off the cuff, something which has been constructed between parties that are not natural bedfellows in the same way that the previous government, the current government, the current coalition managed to somehow put a government together. We hadn't expected those parties to want to sit together, but in the interest of having a government, they managed somehow to compromise enough in order to form a government. Here we've got a group of parties who've been stuck together for already quite a lengthy period of time, including in previous governing coalitions. So this is not something that's just been constructed off the cuff, and you would have imagined that these little issues that could potentially drive them apart have really kind of been resolved. They've been thought about. They've been vocalized. They've been discussed. People have understood where the conflicts are. And yet now that the coalition seems like it's about to take power, now these issues are starting to come out. I was surprised that the Religious Zionist Party decided to meet with the president in each of its three constituent parts rather than as a grouping, which is the way that they ran in the election. So it shows a certain splintering that's already starting to take place within this governing coalition that looked a fairly cohesive group until the last few days. And here we have the president sort of making these comments to Shas. Maybe he's making the comments to all of the parties, I don't know. But it's certainly something that's been slightly controversial and has been reported quite widely in the press.
Yeah, very, very interesting. But as I said, I'm not sure that it's such a it's such an outrageous comment at all. Much has been mentioned about this override clause. What is an override clause?
So the religious parties who are entering the coalition feel highly dissatisfied with the operations of Israel's Supreme Court. They feel that the Supreme Court rulings that have been handed down have somehow been anti-religious, have been anti their people, and they have felt hard done by when it comes to Supreme Court rulings. And they have approached Prime Minister-elect to say, we need to find a way to somehow cancel the Supreme Court's power, or at least reduce the Supreme Court's power, when particularly taking on issues of laws that have been passed through the Knesset. So let's take one example, which is really on the table right now. It is the IDF recruitment bill. And previously, a previous government decided to implement a law that said even ultra-Orthodox members would need to serve in the IDF in some way, shape or form in the same way as other Israelis are required to do, because up until now the rule has been that if members of the ultra-Orthodox community are in a yeshiva and they signed up and they attend and there are certain rules that apply, if they do those, then they are not required to serve in the IDF. And that law was changed. And when it was challenged in the Supreme Court did not choose to change the law. In other words, the Supreme Court supported the law. And so now the ultra-Orthodox parties have come saying, well, we need a way to somehow counter the Supreme Court, not only when that the Supreme Court potentially supports certain laws, but more specifically when the Supreme Court does not support certain laws. So, for example, on this particular issue of the recruitment to the IDF, the Supreme Court did choose somehow to take a slightly changed view from the law that was promulgated in order to amend the law slightly. And the ultra-Orthodox parties really took offense to that Supreme Court position where they decided either to change the law or potentially to set the law aside because they feel that it's not in keeping with whatever was intended. The issue that we have here is that we don't have a constitution. So when you take challenges like this, for example, to the US Supreme Court, then the Constitution is the ultimate test as to what is lawful and what is not lawful. And even though there have been amendments to the Constitution is really regarded as the ultimate rule, and nobody can really override the Constitution, not even the body that promulgates laws. And in Israel, we don't really have a constitution at all. And instead of a constitution, we have this thing called the arrangements law, which gets changed from time to time. And so this override clause is really an attempt to dilute the power of the Supreme Court of Israel when making decisions about whether laws are okay that have been passed by the Knesset. And so the idea of the override law is to allow the Knesset to say, we're not abiding by that decision of the Supreme Court. That's really the bottom line of the story. And I think it's a very, very dangerous precedent to set, because the Supreme Court really needs to have an element of independence about its operations. And even if the Supreme Court decides that a certain law is not lawful for one reason or another, there needs to be some respect given to that Supreme Court decision. And yet, you know, the ultra-Orthodox parties are really taking this to a very personal level, thinking that it's particular judges on the bench of the Supreme Court who hold certain anti-religious views who are going to come out and you know, oppose the views that they take. I think it's a dangerous way to go. And particularly where we don't have a constitution, we need to have this ultimate body that is entitled to take a view even on the work that the Knesset does.
Absolutely right. You know, there's a famous thing, certainly when I was at university and we would talk about constitutional law, and the comment that our then lecturer made was, what you have to do is imagine your biggest enemy in power, in government, and then see if the courts have the ability to curtail them. So don't think about the Nelson Mandelas. Think about the worst person you could think of. And if they're in government, is there a way to curtail them? And the reality is that South Africa's seen that. We've seen that under Jacob Zuma, and it was only because of the Constitutional Court and our independent judiciary, along with along with some other factors. But that was the main driver that actually managed to hopefully put an end to everything that we were dealing with. Without that, it's a very, very dangerous, and people are quite vulnerable.
I agree. And of course, you know, it's increasingly sensitive with the ongoing court case taking place in the background against the prime minister elect. That's also a fact. They might, you know, choose to set aside that particular case. There are a lot of dangerous places where this can go to. It's not clear that Benjamin Netanyahu will listen to the religious parties and will be willing to implement this override clause. But it's certainly something that's lurking in the background, and it gives a lot of concern to many people here who feel that we somehow need the independence of the judiciary, and that needs to be sacred. That needs to be sacred.
Absolutely
and
right. And finally, Israel has been accused of striking Iranian targets in Syria. What more is known about this?
Again, this time actually on the border between Syria and Iraq, which is not really a place that Israel attacks a great deal. I think there have been attacks carried out by Israeli forces previously, but this was really a Wall Street Journal article actually that raised, that said Israel was involved in carrying out these so-called mysterious overnight attacks. And it seems as if though there have been movements from Iran through Iraq towards Syria, and one of the things that was mentioned in this particular shipment is fuel, that fuel tankers were in this convoy of vehicles that Israel attacked. There was also a report that some people were killed in the attack that was carried out. Of course, it's not for certain that it was an Israeli attack, although the Wall Street Journal seems quite sure that it was initiated by Israel. But it seems as if though there was a convoy of some 15 trucks, including oil tankers that were moving fuel from Iran through Iraq to Syria and ultimately probably to Lebanon, we think.
Absolutely, absolutely incredible that this just continues almost every single week. Anthony Reich, thank you as always. Well, thank you for a great week of reporting. Wishing you a fantastic weekend, a Shabbat Shalom. And of course, we will catch you on Monday morning at 7:45 for the Israel Report.
That Israel Report was brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands. Owning properties in Israel can be a great investment, but challenging to manage if you're based abroad. The Blue Agency will manage every aspect of your property, finding and vetting tenants, maintaining your property and getting it rental ready, negotiating contracts and collecting rentals, reporting back to you regularly. The Blue Agency has built a reputation for trust and confidentiality over 20 years. The Blue Agency, your Israel property is in good hands. Contact us at www.theblueagency.com.